Welcome to IMTV. I'm Alan Keyes, and this is Let's Talk America. I want to say hello and a shout out to the folks who are now providing the platform, the secure platform, for broadcasting the shows that we broadcast on this channel, Brighteon TV. I'm really grateful that Mike Adams and his folks have been working with us, and we have been working with them and others, so that this platform, which consists really of interviews with people who are not ashamed of God and don't have a problem talking about the founding of this country and actually take such things deeply seriously, I think it's really important that they have helped to build this platform, and we have helped and participated in building it, and that it now is providing a safe haven for people who are trying to address not only politics in the usual sense of who gets elected, but politics in the sense of really representing the polites, the city, the polity, and the people who make it up, so that our conscience and our thoughts and our ideas are going to be relevant to what the government does. My guest today is Alex Newman. He's been on the show before. He's somebody who I think thinks very well about these kinds of challenges and across a fairly broad range of things that are happening that impact how we are faring in the world and how this country is faring in terms of upholding the founding premises and principles that allow us to continue to be a self-governing people, a people in which the government is of, by, and for the people, not the people for the government. And glad to welcome you to the show today. And we were talking before the show began, because Alex, as always, is involved in interviewing people and looking at things that are going on. And you went back to or were involved with something connected with my old haunt at the United Nations, where I spent some time. And they were talking about something that, of course, we hear a lot about, but it seems like they are now coming up with a perspective on this issue of climate change that then has led them to think that it provides a kind of basis for reconfiguring the understanding of what we as human beings are on this earth to do. And what's important to me is they're focusing on nature, but and that, by the way, is not does not make me uncomfortable, because after all, the country was founded on respect for the laws of nature and of nature's God. That's why ordinary folks who throughout most of human history didn't have much of a claim to be ruling over others, much less over themselves. And it was on the grounds of that appeal. But of course, it was an appeal that didn't see nature as something in and of itself, but saw nature as a product of God's thought and intervention and intention and purpose, so that our very humanity represents an exercise of God's will in respect of the creation of the human race and the first commandment, be fruitful and multiply and inhabit the earth. I wish I could think, Alex, that what you found as the United Nations was somehow tying all of that to climate change was in line with what I just discussed, because then we would happily work with it. But what is your impression of how they are approaching this issue and the meeting that you were able to interview some folks at and be at? Are they going to satisfy my sense of what could be a good, conscientious way to pursue this subject?
No, Alan, no, definitely not. Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I did go to Egypt for the UN Climate Change Summit. They do it every year. This was the COP27, and I've been going to them for like 12 or 13 years now. It's been very interesting. But this was by far the most religious of the events that I've been at. They had over 40 religious events at this summit, and they really brought in religion and religions as a major component. But I love how you started off the discussion, Alan, because when I think of the laws of nature and nature's God, you know, I'm going back to the context that the founding fathers were thinking in. You know, Sir William Blackstone author of Commentaries on the Laws of England, had some really powerful insight into what this means, this idea of the laws of nature. And as you explained, this is the expression of God's will, God's desire for mankind, his principles that he has ordained and established. And so that's the framework that the founding fathers were operating in. When you look now at what's coming out of these UN conferences, and they had this major religious ceremony. Again, I know the vast majority of Americans have not even heard any of these things because the American media was conspicuously silent on this, even though there were thousands of so-called journalists there, almost no coverage in America. But they actually came up with a new Ten Commandments, Alan. And even before the conference got started, the secular side of the UN, the UN Development Program, they put out a policy document where they argued that the ethical and moral codes that had developed with humanity over thousands of years, they actually said evolved with humanity over thousands of years, were really no longer adequate to the task of caring properly for Mother Earth and for Mother Nature. So they said, we got to come up with a new ethical system, a new moral system that will take this into account. So they actually developed a new Ten Commandments. For weeks, they framed it as the new Ten Commandments after they got a lot of pushback and said, wait a minute, that's heretical, that's sacrilegious, that's insane. They said, well, it's just an addendum to the Ten Commandments is what one of the organizers told me. It's not going to replace them. It's just an addendum. But he said, we're also working on the third covenant so that mankind can build the real kingdom of heaven here on earth. I mean, this is the language that these so-called religious leaders are using. And what should become immediately apparent to everyone is that this has nothing in common with the biblical worldview, the framework that our founders were operating in when they talked about the laws of nature and nature's God. And one of the organizers of this, his name was Rabbi Yonatan Narrell. Really nice guy. You know, it seems like it would have been a nice guy to go have a beer with or something. Really, really swell individual. But I think one of the things he told me just perfectly encapsulated their view of things. And he pretended like he was quoting scripture. He wrote this commentary on the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. He calls it the Eco-Bible. And with money from the UN, from the Henry Luce Foundation, from others, they're distributing this all over the world to Christian leaders, Jewish leaders, etc. And when he quoted Genesis to me, he said that God put the human being in the garden to serve it. And I'm like, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. So, you know, I didn't say anything. I couldn't blow my cover there. But I came home and I looked up all the major English translations of the Bible, and I never found anywhere any translation suggesting that God put mankind in the garden to serve it. There's variations in the translation, but we were put here to tend the garden. We were put here to develop the garden, to improve the garden, to glorify God through our efforts in the garden, but certainly not to serve the creation, much less to worship the creation. And as you dig into these Ten Commandments, that is really what they're calling for, this pantheistic view of kind of the earth as a living organism, that we need to recognize God in everything. Very, very bizarre stuff, Alan, and I think this is a hugely significant story that's been almost entirely missed by the media in the United States.
Well, I think that quietly in all that you have just been talking about, there is a change in priority because Adam is placed in the garden to tend the garden, yes, but the first command is the command to Adam, right? Be fruitful and multiply. So you are tending the garden, but with a view to what? With a view to making manifest God's purposes and intentions for humanity. In other words, the focal point of that initial aspect of creation, and it sort of holds through, true, I think, especially in the biblical accounts all through, is God's understanding of what humanity is and how humanity can best be fruitful, right? Bear good fruit, but also perpetuate itself. And that would mean, in some ways, at that point, from an eternal perspective, even as the world, with no intention that we would live as we do now in the presence of something that represents the end of life and then has components that restore, if you have lived rightly, that chance to be, as it were, the expression of God's goodwill. Am I making sense?
You are, Alan. And one of the things
changed the aspect of worship. I mean, people, usually when I think of worship, I think first and foremost of worshiping God. That then puts other things in their place as things that have to be respected on account of God's will for them, right? But you're not worshiping God. It sounds to me like this is nature worship we're talking about.
It really is, Alan. And I think actually there's a perfect example that I want to give that just really drives home the point that you just mentioned. The very first command, of course, as you pointed out, was to be fruitful and multiply. Well, the lady who, one of the ladies who is really running this whole religious component of this, her name is, she just took over an organization that is a partner of the UN, that's funded by the UN. It's called Religions for Peace. Very, very powerful, prominent organization that is deeply involved in this effort. And it had a member of the Council on Foreign Relations who was running it, but just in 2019, the torch was passed to a new person. Her name is Azza Karam. She's the Secretary General of a group called Religions for Peace. And before taking up her post running Religions for Peace, she was actually running the UN Population Control Agency called the UN Population Fund. She's a senior executive there. And of course, people who are familiar with the UN Population Fund know that the entire purpose of this agency is actually to reduce the number of people on the planet. And so it's not just the command to be fruitful and multiply that is being targeted by the UN, because after all, having a large family is not sustainable, right? And they specifically say this. Just a few years ago, they were complaining about Kenyan women, right? How dare Kenyan women have 4.1 children per woman? We need to go in there with more abortions and contraceptions, and we need to brainwash these young women in school so they won't have families and things. So they're very openly hostile to that. This is an inversion of the morality that God gave humanity, starting with the first command and then going through all the rest of them, right? When you boil this down to its essence, it is an inversion of the biblical morality that God has delivered to the human being from the Garden of Eden all the way up through the Ten Commandments and then even into the New Covenant. And you see all these major religions of the world joining with each other. You've got Hindus, you've got major Orthodox leaders, you've got Protestant leaders, you've got even the Vatican sending a delegation. You've got they flew in a shaman from the Amazon rainforest as a representative of indigenous spirituality. They've got Buddhists and Shintos and all these different religious leaders coming together and saying, you know what, we all pretty much have the same virtues. We're going to organize our principles around UN Agenda 2030. So as far as I'm concerned, this is a hijacking, a weaponization of religion away from true religion, right, which the Bible describes as taking care of widows and orphans and, of course, doing your best to glorify God and be obedient to God, into something that's radically new, really an inversion of the morality that God has delivered to us.
Well, I do think that it seems to take our minds away from thinking through God's intention for us and focuses on God's intention for nature. But if God's intention for nature was primary, why did he make us? As a part of nature, that then, aside from God himself, can also contemplate our place in nature and the relationship of nature to our sustenance and so forth. And I find it interesting that these people would be thinking about turning away from our, not necessarily preoccupation, but our sense of God's focus and priority, that we should be taking care of ourselves in his universe and see the universe as a commodious place for doing so, right? At the very moment when, from a scientific point of view, it seems to me that what used to be the sense of Earth that encompassed only this ball, right? But did not necessarily correspond, and I'm raising this to kind of ask a question. In the biblical account, it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth was void and empty, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And I've often wondered, since only later do we hear about the creation of the planets, which and the therefore the things that are circling the various stars and the light givers and so forth and so on, that word Earth at that point seems to have a kind of amorphous connotation, referring to the fact, once we have gotten to know the universe a little better, that this planet does not appear to be the only kind of planet there is, right? So we can either, and I usually, from a biblical point of view, assume that this is a starting point. Right, and when he says, be fruitful and multiply and inhabit the earth, I'm not entirely sure that just means this earth. But it could also mean that which is earth in all the different parts of the universe, which then is a urge to explore and go look and see what things are like, but always with a view to expanding our understanding of our place in the universe, which God seems to encourage us to do. So tending the garden may or may not refer to a little garden, behind the house. It may refer to the garden that is, in point of fact, an expanse of God's intention that could turn out to be far vaster than we think. Am I making sense?
You are, Alan. And actually, there's some really interesting references in some of these UN documents that I referred to. One that I want to mention specifically, that I approached it just very briefly, but it's put out by the UN Development Program. And I'm actually going to quote from it. There's some really interesting things in here. This was a document they put out right before the climate summit called Uncertain Times, Unsettled Lives, Shaping Our Future in a Transforming World. And there's something really strange in this, and it actually goes right along with what you're talking about. In this report, after talking about that the old morality doesn't really work anymore, we need this new moral system, they get into something about non-human entities. You'll read this on page 60 of this report, and I'm going to quote directly from here. It says, focusing on people-planet relationships highlights additional barriers and potentially new dimensions of inclusiveness. It opens avenues to explore moral or ethical questions around including non-human entities and the risks and impacts imposed on those entities through various policy choices. Now, it doesn't... One of the guys who I talked with this about, Daniel Natal, he does the show called Daniel Natal Show, says, if they were talking about animals, why not just say animals? If they're talking about plants, why not just talk about plants? And so I dug into this a little bit. The UN actually has an Agency of Outer Space Affairs, and about a decade ago, this was reported worldwide in the media, including the mainstream media, they were going to appoint an ambassador to aliens, right? And I mean, that sounds crazy, that sounds ridiculous, and yet now we know the U.S. government is promoting all kinds of this stuff, and they were going to appoint this lady, who was at the time running the UN Office of Space Affairs, to be the ambassador to extraterrestrial life. So I think there is a component of this, even in what the UN is talking about, that we're not quite getting to yet. And I won't pretend to understand the full implications of all this, but I do think that the UN has something fishy in mind. And I do think a lot of the major religions of the world have been talking about this as well. Even in recent years, they've talked about the possibility of extraterrestrial life and things. So we have Elon Musk now talking about exploring Mars. But when you take all of this together, I think we're talking really about two fundamentally different ways of viewing humanity, different ways of understanding the universe, different ways of understanding what is the purpose, all the existential questions, the most important questions. Why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing? How should I be living? And the UN has a very different vision than the vision that somebody would gather from reading and believing the Bible.
What I'm intrigued by, as I'm listening to you, is what you're describing seems to be based on an assumption that our options in responding to that first command, be fruitful and multiply and inhabit the earth, right, is that somehow we're more constrained or confined in our way of understanding that than we used to be. And yet, if you put that side by side with thinking about the exploration of the universe, it seems a little contradictory. Since one aspect of who we are now, which is technological advances of one kind or another, though not necessarily good in and of themselves, are going to, we assume, become good for doing what we can now do more expeditiously on this planet itself, which is go from one place to another, looking around for what's here, and so forth and so on, and making use of it. But that seems to be, when you look at the stars in the heavens, and we know now that a lot of those stars seem to have plants circling them, just like we have plants circling our planet. And no matter how you look at it, whether you think that if I, Alan, am going to pretend that maybe the word Earth in the Bible is something that carries more weight than just this planet. You know, the word human or might very well refer to something that is not just this will of God for his creation of the sentient being we call ourselves human, right? I don't know that for sure, but I think we're now getting closer and closer to being able to take a look. And as we are getting closer to take a look. We're also close to and in the midst of a time, really, when if we think it through, we can take care of ourselves as we look much better than would have been the case in the past. What is it they're afraid of that they want the multiply part to necessarily be part of that adventure? Or not part of, to exclude it from that adventure? Because they seem to be fruitful, don't multiply, and pretty much stick around the earth. But that's not the command. I wonder if Christians have even thought this through sometimes. But I think we are now at a point where our conception of God's intention for our exploration has to be expanded. Unless we mean to confine ourselves by hook or crook to an ambition that doesn't reflect God's, the expansive nature of God's understanding of the whole since he created it, right? And he seems to give us the ability to follow in his footsteps, not necessarily to do better than he does, but to learn more and more about this universe so that it reflects more of our sense. And it would be a combination of becoming a little more bold because we can go out there and look at more, but also being totally abashed in terms of the humility we have to take with us. They seem to be combining a sense of, I don't know, limitation with a sense that neglects that humble willingness to follow God's command. Am I making sense in that? Because it's a complicated thought.
Yep.
But I think it goes a little bit beyond what you are describing, because they seem to be so limited in their sense of what is our relationship to God's purpose in the universe.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Alan. I think this is a topic that theologians should have started discussing a long time ago. But really, if you look at the UN's vision for humanity as laid out in the final agreement out of this thing and in all that they've been doing, they want less resources, they want less people, they want more control over people, exactly the types of things that would constrain us and prevent us from being able to accomplish the types of things that you're describing. And I know we got to go to break, but we can pick this up on the other side too. So.
Yeah, well, we'll be back in a bit because another thought came across my mind as you were describing that one. We'll get to it. We'll be right back after this.
The world we once knew is collapsing. We're being warned to expect rolling blackouts, and our political leaders are deliberately shutting down pipelines, fuel refineries, nuclear power plants, and energy exploration. The currency is collapsing, while financial assets are plummeting in value, and the global food supply is being deliberately decimated. To survive this war being waged on humanity, you need more than just regular prepping. You need resilient prepping. And that's the title of my new free audiobook, Resilient Prepping. You can download the entire audiobook and a printable PDF transcript for free right now at resilientprepping.com. Resilient Prepping teaches practical strategies for prepping in three layers: high-tech, low-tech, and no-tech. Resilient Prepping is your ultimate guide to surviving the total collapse of the world as we know it, because that's exactly what globalists are trying to achieve. Download this entire audiobook for free right now at resilientprepping.com.
The Kelly Key easily converts your AR rifle to bolt action, allowing you to keep the rifle you love in assault weapon jurisdictions. The Kelly Key is a true fast drop-in solution. No permanent changes to your rifle. Import, transport, own, and have fun with your AR. Why the Kelly Key? Because a bolt action is not an assault weapon. Stay future ready from gun bans with a Kelly Key. The Kelly Key also lets you quickly and easily build your ideal hunting rifle, lets you build a quiet a suppressed rifle, and benefits your long-range precision shooting. Available now at KellyKey.com with free shipping.
Your own government has the power to activate a kill switch on all telecommunications, instantly shutting down all private phone calls and texts. An EMP weapon or solar flare can achieve the same result. Rolling blackouts or permanent power outages will also take out the power supply to cell tower antennas, rendering mobile devices all but useless. During these emergencies, how do you stay in touch with the important people in your life anywhere on the planet? The answer? Is the Bivy Stick at SAT123.com. The Bivy Stick is a two-way satellite text messaging device that uses a satellite constellation, not cell towers, to send and receive text messages. It works anywhere on planet Earth, including in war zones or blackout areas. In unpredictable times, the Bivy Stick helps you stay connected when it matters most. Visit SAT123.com to get one.
Welcome back. I'm having an absolutely fascinating and, for me, kind of enjoyable conversation with Alex Newman. And I find it interesting because these folks are one and the same time in the description you are giving of their understanding and priorities. They are at one and the same time telling us that there are too many of us, right? And when I think about that, I think, well, too many for what purpose or with what view of the universe in mind? Since one of the reasons that you move from one place to another is because you want more room. That was a natural impetus for human beings to move about, spread, get to know more of the world. They didn't stay in one place because they started to feel a little bit confined in that place, right? And yet these people seem to be afraid of that phenomenon, which I think we have also become better at and better at using and seeing and understanding the possibilities of the earth, so we produce a lot more. You see what I'm saying? But obviously that may have limits because everything in the material world seems to operate according to limits. But we're getting to the point where we can also do more than speculate about getting way beyond that limit in one sense, so that we'll be going to other planets and having a look and trying to figure out whether they can accommodate human life. Why do they assume that the multiply part of God's injunction wasn't a way of making sure that we impelled ourselves, that we had the ambition to go look and explore? Wouldn't that make sense?
It would. You know, as you're, I haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about this, Alan, but I'm glad you're talking about it. As you're talking, I'm thinking of Genesis chapter 11, where God has told the people of the planet, this is after, you know, Noah and his family, and several generations after, and he says to these people, hey, you're supposed to be spreading out. And instead, they're building this big giant tower, and God had told them very clearly, spread out across the whole face of the earth. They're like, no, we're good. We're just going to build this big, huge tower here. And the UN is almost like the epitome of the Tower of Babel, right? This crazy concoction, bringing together all the worst impulses of humanity, all the mass murdering dictators and gangsters and kleptocrats of the world. They said, we're going to run everything. We're going to build this tower up to God. You actually have very senior officials within the UN, people like Robert Mueller, Assistant Secretary General of the UN. He once described the UN in a book as the body of Christ, right? They look at the UN as almost this kind of religious thing where we're going to ascend to the heights of the heavens. And meanwhile, God told us to spread out and be fruitful and multiply and go across the whole face of the earth. And as I'm thinking about what you're saying, if you were to follow through on the UN's ideas, right? The UN has this worldview that resources are limited. There's too many people already consuming these resources. First of all, it shows a fundamental misunderstanding of the economy and of what pricing does, right? They say, well, we're going to run out of pick your resource, right? XYZ resource. Well, if they had a basic understanding of basic economics and the laws of supply and demand and pricing, what they would understand is that, did we freeze?
No.
Oh, okay. What they would understand is that, when prices go higher for something as a result of it becoming more scarce, as a result of the supply being very low or being reduced, alternatives come up, right? So, there was a big concern over 100 years ago about running out of whale oil. What are we going to do if we run out of whale oil? Well, that ended up not being a problem because as the price of whale oil went up, people found substitutes, people went to kerosene, people went to other technologies. And so that wasn't an issue anymore, right? And that's the same with what we're dealing with today. The UN says we're going to run out of oil. No, we're not going to run out of oil. They say we're going to run out of land. We're not going to run out of land. There's plenty of space on this planet. There's plenty of agricultural productivity. And what they're not taking into account, I don't know if this is deliberate or if they're just dumb. I suspect it's deliberate. But what they're not taking into account is that as the population grows and prosperity levels grow, we have more human minds working on these problems, right? And so I think what you're saying is brilliant and really deserves to be considered. We now have the technology. In fact, Elon Musk has made very clear that his objective is to set up a human settlement on Mars in his lifetime. And so he's already sending rockets up. We've got, you know, electric vehicles that can operate in an atmosphere that where you can't use an internal combustion engine. We've got the technology. We've got enough people to make this possible. We've got enough minds to make this possible. And the UN is focused on how do we reduce the number of people? How do we make everybody poorer? It's a very, very bizarre contrast between what could be and what the UN is advocating.
Raises a question for us because God went so far when he looked at the people who were just building the tower and wanted to stay in one place and so forth. What did he do? And I have spent some time in the course of my life pondering this because at first it seems, almost a little bit, how can I put it, malicious. Because he looks at them and says, well, maybe this is because they are all of one language. Let's put a lot of different languages out there so that they'll disperse. He actually takes a positive step and says, no, they can't stay this way. Make sure that they spread out and go away from each other and so forth and so on. So it's obviously a positive part of our vocation from God's vantage point that we shouldn't sit around just enjoying the place. Or not, as the case may be, I don't know. But we should realize that he has provided for us a more vast extent of exploratory territory, which is why it made sense for him to say, be fruitful and multiply and inhabit the earth. And now that we have got a sense that that word earth doesn't necessarily confine us to this planet, I would have expected that there would be some excitement about that. And as we develop, we would take the steps necessary to do what we did on the Earth, right? Extending our sense of what that means. And the candidate people talk about a lot because it seems to be the most likely place right now is Mars. But that means that our multiplication isn't necessarily a bad thing because we'll start to get to the point where we'll be able to leave the planet that we're filling up in order to visit other places that could be inhabitable. And that could be our incentive to understand how we can relate to those places most effectively using the knowledge that we have acquired on account of this wonderful instrument of thought and exploration, our minds, that God has given us. They seem to be a little bit not just turning away from God in the abstract, but kind of assuming that we're on our own, despite the fact that God made a provision for our abilities and talents that goes beyond the narrow purview of what we might think we can achieve on our own. You see what I'm saying?
I do. And you know, it's quite ironic, too. If the UN gets their way on these issues, we may want to get off of this planet for the same reason that people wanted to leave the old world and come settle the new world. Right? I mean, they're so out of control. They want to have religious tyranny. They want to have control over every element of our lives. I think living on another planet may be kind of appealing in 15 to 20 years if this UN agenda, this Agenda 2030, these climate change programs continue. Are you really going to want to be here? And the answer is probably no. Mars may offer kind of an escape hatch to get us out of here. So it's such a fascinating discussion, Alan. And I don't think it's something that the overwhelming majority of people have thought about. But we now are at a stage in human development where it is time to start thinking about these things. We've learned a lot of lessons over the last few thousand years of human history about what works and what doesn't. We know private property is a really valuable tool. We know that free markets, that the rules that God has ordained for economic systems end up producing a lot of prosperity. Right? Thou shalt not steal is pretty clear. If you don't work, you don't eat, as St. Paul, the Apostle Paul, put it. We've got all these valuable lessons, and we see that in the Earth context, they worked really well, right? If you let people be economically free, America being Exhibit A, they will become very prosperous. They'll come up with new technologies. It wouldn't it be a hilarious fit of irony if the UN made life on this planet so miserable that, we just had to have a new group of settlers finding a new place where humans could exist without this clown car formerly known as the United Nations dictating every element of our lives, what resource we can use, how many children we could have, and things like that. Because that really is the direction that these people are going. If they were left to their own devices, individual liberty on this planet would cease to exist. No question.
And also, I think part of that which we need to be aware of and focusing on more than we do. One lesson I think that has to be taken out of the pandemic period, that they can't decide whether we're in it or out of it. I find that intriguing. Why would that be such a problem? Wouldn't you just look at the objective facts and be able to ascertain it? Well, no, not if you had the intention of prolonging what the pandemic actually produced, which was more control over more people everywhere on Earth, right? So that the concentration of power in the hands of the few suddenly emerges on the scene, reclaiming what had been its definite priority in every different part of the Earth. But we were growing out of it. And the United States, I think, is a particular example of that outgrowth, where you start to see that human potential as somehow something you need to respect in each and every individual, in all the communities, and so forth and so on, so that you don't feel bound to rule them, but bound to help provide the space in which they can explore their possibilities, which is different than the kind of totalitarian rule these people seem to be bound to impose. What if that's their real intention, though, right? To sort of give us a sense, a limited sense of what we are about, that confines our aspirations in such a way as to justify the kind of constriction of our possibilities that they seem bent on imposing. Does that make sense? Because I think this is all very self-serving from the point of view of the elitists who are coming up with it.
Yep, I think so too, Alan. And as I was digging into these religious events that were happening, these coalitions, these new Ten Commandments, one of the things that I looked at is, you know, where's the funding coming from? What's the background of these people? And one of the things that just pops up over and over and over again, and I'm not sure how much of this you saw while you were at the UN, there's a lot of New Age stuff. There's a lot of occultism, and it's just right beneath the surface. You really don't have to dig very far to find it. I mentioned Robert Mueller earlier, the Assistant Secretary General of the UN back some decades ago. He also is known as the father of global education. He was a disciple of Alice Bailey. Now, Alice Bailey, for the folks who don't know, she was the founder of the Lucifer Publishing Company. She published Lucifer Magazine, and she had gotten it into her head. She and many other very influential people that looked to Alice Bailey and theosophy. She was, of course, a disciple of Helena Blavatsky. You know, if you could try to condense this bizarre New Age occult religion into just a few words, they got it into their heads that Lucifer was the good guy, and that God was this mean, oppressive tyrant who was keeping us confined in this garden. And then Lucifer shows up and brings light and brings knowledge to humanity. So they've got the story completely backwards. And so it's not surprising then that they would pursue policies that would be completely contradictory to God's designs, to God's intentions, to God's purposes for mankind, that would allow us to flourish, that would allow us to explore, that would allow us to be fruitful and to multiply and to bring the earth into submission and really to use it for the glory of God and to develop. And I mean, it's, you know, when you connect all these dots, you see something very nefarious going on within the UN system and a lot of these, you know, para-UN institutions that have joined with it and that are aligned with it. And I think the motivations here, in my view, are frightening. They're very dangerous. They need to be exposed. And what I find so troubling is how so many religions now are willing to hitch their wagon to this UN crazy train, even though what they're teaching is so obviously contradictory to what Scripture teaches, to what God teaches. It really is quite dangerous. And I think it will limit human potential if it's allowed to continue in such a massive way that we may find ourselves really in a food crisis and in an energy crisis and in just needing the very basic things of life.
Well, they seem to almost, because if you're more interested in culling the herd than in encouraging a creative approach to how the herd occupies itself, right? If you want to call it that. In other words, instead of trying to kill people off, which I'm sad to say, I don't know if everybody has reached this conclusion. I look back over these pandemic couple of years, I thought it was a dress rehearsal for mass murder.
Yep.
And that they are actually getting away with it, and that people are asleep at the wheel and don't realize the implications. And the important question has to be, why do you want to kill us off? They're pretending that everything's so desperate, yet some of the most prosperous countries in the world, including Japan and so forth, are also the most populous. per, you know, densely populated. So these two things don't go together unless you have another agenda. Because the agenda that works itself out according to the laws of nature and of nature's God, our ability to expand our reach seems to be growing along with our population, so that it will eventually, as it did on Earth itself, become an outlet so that people can move somewhere and continue the adventure. Are they trying to kill us and kill that adventure? Because I think that's what explains why so much of this seems to be quietly, deeply critical of the way of life we have established in America, and everything they're doing to try to topple us from a position that we didn't get by beating everybody else up and conquering everybody else. We just became such an attractive place to come that people came from all over the world to join in. And I think that is now, it's an objective to kind of get people away from the nation with who we are and how we did it, even though when I say we, people who represent pretty much every race, nation, language, and group on the face of the earth, to be becoming an example of how that can, in fact, build a common human identity without destroying the aspirations that grow out of our diversity. Does that make sense? Because I think there's something wrong with what these people are trying to do. They're not telling us the truth.
I think that's actually what's happening, Alan. One of the ways that you can prove that the ringleaders of this climate cult don't actually believe what they're saying is that the policies they are advocating will have the effect of producing massively more CO2 emissions into the atmosphere. And this is very clear, right? They're deindustrializing the United States. They're shutting down our power plants, which is going to lead to our factories, our manufacturing being shipped over to China. Now, under these agreements, you know, I was in Paris when the UN came up with the Paris Agreement. The communist Chinese government said, we're going to keep increasing our CO2 emissions until at least 2030. Just in the next couple of years, they're going to bring more coal-fired power plants online than we have in the United States in total. So if you really thought CO2 was a toxic pollution, the gas we exhale, the worst thing in the world for you to do would be to shut down industry and manufacturing in the United States and ship it over to communist China, where there's all kinds of real pollution and where, I mean, the communist Chinese already emit 300% more CO2 than America. They emit more than double the CO2 of all the Western world combined. And then you have people like Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum, which signed a strategic partnership with the UN to implement Agenda 2030. Saying publicly just a couple weeks ago, right after the UN climate summit ended, that communist China offers a very attractive model for other countries to follow. They don't want countries to follow the American model of individual liberty, of free enterprise. They want people to look at communist China as a success. Now, how did communist China become successful? We shot ourselves in the foot. We cut off our own nose to spite our face. The communist Chinese stole all of the American technology from our companies, from our government, etc. They used that to industrialize very rapidly with a fascistic system. And now that's the system that's being built up by these UN policies that's being promoted. But if you go one step further and look at it a little deeper, you know, why this hatred for humanity? Why this hatred for the things that make us prosperous? And I think really you can't understand this outside of the context of the Bible, outside of the context of this is diabolical. This comes from the pit of hell. Right? The Bible teaches that every human being is made in the image of God. So how could you hate the human being so much that you want to encourage and spread abortion all over the world? You want to see the dismembering of innocent little babies under the guise of sustainable development and population control? The only answer I can come to is that this is diabolical, it's satanic, it is evil. And, you know, they market it as good, but it is at its core diabolical.
And see, I think as you're describing it and we've been discussing it, you have people coming forward with a vision of what we're all going to get together and accomplish that has as its underlying message that we shall be as gods.
Yep.
Right? That satanic message that was brought to Adam and Eve to kind of lure them down the wrong path. Oh, you're not going to die. You shall be as gods. God's intention for you is not going to be filled. You shall be as gods. So you don't have to think about life according to God because you can make life up without any attention to the laws of nature and of nature's God. So at one and the same time, they are offering us a kind of a nature worship, right, as a substitute for the worship of God, which then impels us to see ourselves in the context of what he intends us to do. But at the same time that they do that, they're encouraging us to shrink back from the challenge of what God means us to be, which is, as individuals, people challenged to be fruitful and multiply and to follow his guidance without being constricted by it, because he wants us to be fruitful and multiply and inhabit the world of his creation. Yes? But that combination, to me, then sucks us down a path where at the end of the day, insofar as we exist as a mass, we will be under the control of a powerful elite, so that the few will have realized their dream of controlling the many, including limiting the possibility that their power would be challenged because they become too many to control. I think God means us to be too many to control. He doesn't want any power to control us except the power of his intention, which is already implanted within us, and they want us to look away from that. It strikes me as a very kind of both anti-American but also not very sensible thing to recommend to the human race.
I couldn't agree with you more, Alan. And you know, what comes to mind is 1 Samuel, where, you know, God is talking to the Israelites and they're asking for this king, right? Well, we want a king like all the other nations. And God says, well, hey, you know, I'll give you a king, but here's what's going to happen. And, you know, that's where Americans are today, right? We had a system of government that was based on biblical principles that produced this incredible prosperity, this incredible opportunity. And here is a big part of our population saying, no, we want a king like all the rest of the nations. We want to switch out the wonderful system that you kind of outline in your word. And we want to design one for ourselves that's going to regulate, you know, how many kids we have, what resources we can use, when we can use them, how much electricity we can have. It's very, very sad. And I know we're out of time, Dr. Keyes, but I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss these very important topics with you. And for people who are interested in the articles that I'm doing on climate, they'll be in the first issue for 2023 of the New American Magazine. That's all at thenewamerican.com.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate your coming on. This turned into a really fascinating discussion. Which leaves us, I think, on the brink of kind of considering a question that is actually kind of exciting in the sense of trying to make it clear, which makes us a boulder in the sense of exploring and challenging ourselves to get to know the large expanse of God's universe of which we are now aware. Does a fearful preoccupation with our own little place on this earth, or does a sense of the universe guided by God's word, which draws us into his plans rather than our own, challenge us to rise to the level of that promise, which I think we are already fulfilling, if we will do things his way, using our intelligence according to that conscience, which should respond to his goals in such a way that the be fruitful and multiply part does not imply that we become more and more burdened by our own needs, but that we free ourselves to be more and more driven by the courage that God makes possible. I wish we had more leaders who think like that, but they don't yet. We'll see, because we're, I think, being marshaled by God down that road. Thank you, Alex, for being with me. It's always fascinating. We'll be back right after this.